Hello, and thank you for lending your ears to RateUp.ca's Real Money Talk podcast. In this show, we give you the real talk on all things money. We eliminate the fine print, we junk the jargon, and we explain how you can make smarter financial decisions. We're not millionaires, we're thousandaires, and we know you are too, so this show is for you. We want to talk about money because it affects everyone, rich and poor. Money shouldn't only be the occupation of the 1%, but rather the 99%. Money isn't everything, but it is everywhere. We want to educate about money through story. We Canadians ignore money, hoping if we do, like many other problems, it'll go away. Our goal is to make money an everyday discussion. Thank you for tuning in to the Real Money Talk podcast. With me is guest host John Vassallo, Director of Sales for RateHub.ca and General Manager of Money Sense Magazine. Hello, John.
Hello, everyone.
Our guest on the show today is Eric Dolansky. Eric received his PhD and MBA from the Richard Ivey Business School at Western University. He's now a professor at the Goodman School of Business at Brock University. His main area of research is in studying pricing and price perception, consumer estimations of value, consumer behavior, and behavioral economics. And that's why we brought him on the show today. Hello, Eric.
Hello, how are you?
Doing great. We always kick things off with a money mistake or a money makeup. John, I'm going to let you take this one first.
Awesome. So I actually have a money makeup to tell. It's actually been on my mind for a while. Ever since I started working at RateHub.ca, of course, which compares, you know, checking fees and all that stuff, I realized I was paying way too much money for my banking fees. But for the longest time, I did nothing about it. But come last week, I finally pulled the proverbial trigger, and I am now revisiting my banking products and going to be saving significantly in fees over the last little while by getting rid of my VIP package from my current institution.
I'm always curious, how long did it take you? Did you have a whole template to switch over all of your expenses?
Yeah, so that's the challenge number one, is the headaches around, you know, automatic payments that you have to transfer over and, you know, some checks that you may have already written. In my case, the delay was more so around my wife and I getting married, getting a mortgage, and consolidating some of our finances. So it was just kind of a complete overhaul of everything. And our mortgage got delayed quite a lot, which prevented us from doing some of the other stuff that we wanted to do. But yeah, it's been on my mind for a while. And in reality, I guess it's true for a lot of Canadians. It was just excuses until the excuses had to stop. And here I am now, but it feels great to finally get it done. That's for sure.
Yeah, congratulations. I still haven't done it and it's still on my to-do list. I have a bit of a money makeup. Well, a bit of a money mistake in that I ordered booze from the LCBO and then they stopped delivering and only were delivered to a post office, which you could go pick up due to COVID. But in the meantime, we were running low on booze. So we decided to support local and spend even more on a local winery. We bought some wine from Rose Hill Run and they shipped it and it just LCBO got here before that, which was a 3-week delay time. And we were still waiting on this box and we were in communication with them and I'm calling them out on the show because they ended up sending us a little, like instead of 6 bottles, they sent us an extra bottle and, you know, a wine cleaner out of clothing. And, you know, a water bottle with their logo on it. So I was pretty happy with that one. So I'm going to call that a makeup, but it was just sort of support local in this time. How about you, Eric?
Well, I have something, I think I would call it a money mistake. It's not a recent decision, but it became relevant recently. When we last renegotiated our mortgage, or not renegotiated, renewed our mortgage at the end of the term, we opted for the fixed rate. Because we thought, oh, rates are low, you know, how low could they possibly go? Why would we need a floating rate? And so it's been on my mind a little bit lately because of course, all the changes. So that, I guess, turned out to be a mistake. Of course, there was no way of knowing, but I'm sure we would be saving quite a bit of money right now.
Yeah, we'll see in a few years, I guess. Yeah, John, did you want to kick it off?
Yeah, awesome. So today we're chatting about the psychology of spending. I think it's a pretty interesting subject altogether. What drives people to spend money? What influences consumer behavior? And highly relevant, especially with what's going on right now in the world. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, Eric, what compelled you to focus your research on consumer psychology?
Well, when I was a, I would like to say young, but not that young PhD student, one of the first things you have to do is sort of decide, okay, so I knew I wanted to research marketing, but what within marketing? I mean, that could range from everything from Salesforce compensation to the type of work I do to looking into advertising or looking into supply chain, any of those topics. And as I thought more and more about it, what really interested me as I read some of the literature, some of the academic studies that had been done, was pricing and how people respond to prices. Because in the economic tradition, and it's not so much true anymore, but in the economic tradition, price was sort of seen as a meeting point between supply and demand. And there's so much more to it in terms of how we respond to prices, including what the numbers look like, you know, if they end in 99 or if they're whole numbers, to what that number represents, to what you get as opposed to surcharges. One of the first things I looked into was how we attribute price, you know, whose fault is it that the price is what it is? And what I ultimately settled on for some of my earliest work was price fairness. How do we judge whether or not a price is fair? And that really interested me. There was a lot of opportunity to do good research, but at the same time, there was already a few decades of very interesting work by very prominent behavioral psychologists like Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky and Richard Thaler, two out of the three of whom have won the Nobel Prize for Economics.
Very good. I read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, and I do remember a bunch of the studies he referenced in that book having to do with consumer psychology and basically making those quick decisions based on something like, oh, it costs this much, it must be good, it must have value to it just because of the price versus, you know, if you were to kind of take a step back and evaluate it, you may think otherwise.
That's one of the things when I teach pricing, one of the things the students come up with first, because they're used to it, is similar to what you just said, which is we can sort of infer the value or the quality from the price. And that's something a lot of people rely on being true. And it is true under certain circumstances. Actually, as expertise increases, that sort of goes away. If you imagine you're buying a bottle of wine and you don't know very much about wine, you would definitely use the price as an indicator of how good the wine is. But if you knew a lot about wine, you probably would ignore the price for the most part and go based on the knowledge that you have of the product.
Very interesting too. Another book I read, Robert Cialdini, or Cialdini, I always forget how to pronounce his last name, Influence, Science, and Practice. And I remember a chapter specifically about wine pricing at restaurants. And basically what he was able to prove through his studies was, if you were, you know, most restaurants, you see the price go from cheapest to more expensive. And he was able to prove that if you actually did the opposite, you went from more expensive to cheaper, you're going to increase the amount of mid-range sales you're going to do. Doesn't increase the amount of expensive wines you sell. It'll increase the amount of mid-range sales that you make. Could you kind of explain the psychology about why the simple shift of how you show the pricing of wine on a menu could influence consumer behavior, who chooses what wine?
There's actually two things going on there. And it really, I don't know if you looked me up, because it overlaps a great deal with my own research on how we perceive prices. There are two effects from what are called biases. One is an anchoring effect. So if you see the list from most expensive to least expensive, the first prices you see are very high, and that forms an anchor, that forms a reference point where you're judging the other wines against that. So if you can imagine a price list from high to low, then your anchor, your reference point is very high. And the other prices, as you evaluate them, may look less expensive in comparison. We normally see it where we see a list from low to high. We're starting with a lower reference point, a lower anchor, which makes those mid-range wines seem more expensive. So that's one element. The other element is a framing effect, where we see the ends of the range, they are more or less relevant to us based on things like what order we see them in. But what we're really looking for is something that fits within our acceptable range. And that acceptable range will change from person to person based on what they can afford and how much they intend to spend and how much they value the product. But that range will inform the overall range will inform the individual's acceptable range, their reference range. And so by providing that frame, you are then influencing how they choose, whether that is the order that people see things in or the types of prices you use or how you categorize those prices. I say it overlaps with my own research because I did my thesis research on sequences of prices. So you see prices one at a time and they may be going up steadily or they may be going down steadily. And what I was primarily looking at was how much predictability, how much volatility affects things. But what we did find was if people saw an ascending series of prices, they would not only expect the next prices to be even higher, they would be more accepting of them because they fit with your expectations.
Interesting. Would that be kind of relatable to gas prices? And for the longest time, of course, now that's changed, but for the longest time, people just kind of saw them going up and up and up, and they become more accepting of the gas price increasing over time? Or is there a, you know, sort of like a tipping point where they say, oh, now that's just too much. Oh, it's gone over this price. Now that's just too much. Now it's just getting ridiculous. Is there a tipping point? Or
there would definitely be a tipping point. What that tipping point is unclear. I mean, we've seen incidences. I can remember, for example, when Hurricane Katrina hit, gas prices went up sharply because of all the refineries in the Gulf. The prices went up by about 50%, and you had lineups at the gas station. Now, obviously, there was more going on there. People were worried that they wouldn't be able to get gas. But what the oil and fuel companies have taught us and have learned from us is they haven't found that tipping point yet. There are a couple of other things going on there, though. One is it's a norm that gas prices change every day or sometimes more than once a day. And norms and what we're used to has a lot to do with how we view prices. We are okay with gas prices fluctuating every day. We're kind of okay with airline prices fluctuating every time you go onto the website. And that's because we're used to that. You could have similar products that we're not used to pricing in that manner, and people would be less accepting of it. The other thing that's going on with that is there's a stickiness, there's a switching cost. If gas prices get really expensive, it's not easy for me to find another way to work on short notice, depending on where I live and how I get to work. So I may have to live with those very high gas prices until the next time I buy a new car, for example. So we wouldn't see the effect right away where everyone stops buying gasoline. Instead, we would see that sort of trickle out over time, and of course, complicated by other factors like competition and the price of electric cars and everything else going on.
Speaking of supply and demand and competition and reacting either immediately or in the long term, what is your take on, you know, what's happening right now? What drove so many Canadians to buy, you know, so many rolls of toilet paper during this COVID crisis? You know, was it a fear of not being able to access the product, fear that the prices would go up? Yeah, how does the supply and demand and cultural norms impact the price somebody's willing to pay for a roll of toilet paper?
I think, yes, it's fear that they won't be able to have it or they won't be able to afford it. What was most striking to me is learning that apparently so many Canadians have such a small supply of toilet paper in their house that they don't think they could go a couple weeks without running out and buying some. I think that it became sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy because there were so many news reports about toilet paper. More and more people thought, I better go out and get this because it's going to run out. All pricing at its heart should be based on value. Now, that's not the same thing as all prices that are set are based on value. But from a business standpoint, the way that you can maximize your revenue and profit is by basing your prices on the value that that product has to consumers. And in theory, that works fine. In general, there is a value that toilet paper has in people's minds. Where you run into problems, though, is in situations like this, where you get a store, for example, like Pusateri's with their Lysol wipes, which, if you are unaware of what happened a couple weeks ago, Pusateri's was caught selling one can of Lysol wipes for $30. From a theoretical standpoint, that makes perfect sense. Those Lysol wipes are far more valuable during this situation than they were before it. On the other hand, that's a very short-term way of looking at things. That's a way of saying, I'm going to make a big profit today and tomorrow's profit be damned. Because even if Pusateri's hadn't gotten called out by the media and had pictures of their price all over social media, they still ran a risk of alienating their loyal customers and engendering ill will towards the company. So supply and demand and the value that the product has for the customer only goes so far, because you do have to have longer term considerations as a company.
Do you think after COVID, there will be some companies that are burned by their actions, like the Pusateri's example?
We'd like to think so. As a society, we'd like to think that bad actors get punished. The reference point, the example that I have used for years in my course, is the hotels in Toronto on 9/11/2001 that jacked up their prices and were called out by the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition at the time here in Canada. And yes, they got a lot of bad press. Yes, they were sort of forced in the short term to lower their prices and not charge what people would have been willing to pay. Do we remember specifically which hotels those are today? And furthermore, even if we did remember that the Sheraton was one of them, if you're shopping for a hotel near the airport and the Sheraton's the cheapest and most convenient, are you going to say, it may be the cheapest, it may be the most convenient, but I am not going to stay there because of what they did 19 years ago? I suppose there are some people who might say that. I think most people would probably not say that. With the Pusateri's example, I'm not going to try and predict the future and say this is what's going to happen to them or this is what's not. I think there will be some consumers who will say, I don't want to shop there. But you know what? For a lot of people, if you go over to someone's house and you have some fantastic food item and you ask them where they got it, they say Pusateri's, you may go buy it because you like it. And justify that to yourself and say, well, they just did this one bad thing, and why should I be punished because of something bad that they did?
Yeah, there's also proximity challenges too, right? I remember having a bad experience at a lunch spot in one of my previous jobs and thinking to myself, well, I'm not ever going back there again. But then I was like, oh, wait a minute, there's not too many other options around here. So same thing, if Pusateri's is your only option to grab lunch or grab your groceries, you might have to forgive them and move on. Other people may have a little bit more of a lasting impact.
And it all gets back to what people value. If people value the food most of all, or the specific product they're looking for, then things like this won't matter as much. If they value how they feel about what they buy, then it absolutely will matter.
Absolutely, yeah. Do you think, what kind of impact do you think COVID and what we're going through right now is going to have on Canadian consumer behavior? I mean, what impact has it had right now? We talked about a couple of things: people willing to pay $29.99 or $30 for Lysol wipes, people hoarding toilet paper, and so forth. Anything else that you've noticed that you want to share? And also, like, what are the long-lasting impacts of COVID-19 on consumer behavior?
What I've noticed more than anything else, and I don't know if you would classify this as consumer behavior specifically or just behavior, is how willing pretty much everyone is to say, yes, we need to do this. This is for the benefit of not just me, but everyone. And I'm willing to stay home. I've spoken to family and friends, many of whom have said, yes, you know, that's true now, but who knows if this goes on for another month or two, whether people will still be willing to do that. But if you had said a few months ago, you know what, we may be in a situation where the government's going to have to tell everyone to stay home, they're going to shut down all the businesses, and it's going to be like what they did in Wuhan, China, or you know, this situation that you wouldn't necessarily expect in Canada, I think a lot of people would say that would never work. And the fact that it worked, and the fact that we're all, for the most part, cooperating, a few complainers on social media aside, really says a lot about our expectations. In terms of what's going to happen afterwards, I said before, I'm sort of loath to predict the future. I think that in the short term, it will definitely be on everyone's mind. People may keep a bigger stock of products at home. You may see sales of, whether it's, you know, pantries or bigger freezers or the ability to hoard a little bit. I think that people will look at, what if this happens again? What would I need? But like everything else, no matter how big in our lives, it will fade with time. And if it comes down to it, you know, whether it's saving, for example, you know, what if this happens again and I lose my job? I should have more money in savings because the government may not be able to provide me with assistance then. I think that may affect people's behavior in the short term, but within a few months or a few years, depending on the person, you'll see people say, yeah, I should save, but I really want that thing, or I want to get a new car, or I'm ready to buy a house. I'm sure that, oh man, I managed last time. I'm sure I'll be able to manage this next time.
Interesting. something that we talk about, I mean, my household, we're pretty big travelers, you know, obviously with COVID-19, we actually have a flight booked right now to Europe in September. That's still a go. We haven't canceled it. The airline hasn't canceled it or anything. We're anticipating that happening for sure. But just thinking beyond that, when do you think Canadians or consumers in general are going to be ready and willing to spend money on travel again soon? How long will that take for that industry in particular to pick up?
I think it depends a great deal on the messaging we get from the government. If the government's messaging is everything's back open, we're going to return to normal within a few weeks, everything's going to be fine, because whether it's because we have a vaccine or we have a treatment or the caseload gets low enough, I think people want to return to normal. My family and I, we had a vacation planned. We hadn't booked anything yet for this summer. We're fairly certain that's not going to happen, but the next opportunity we have to make it happen, I think we will once it's safe. There will be a willingness to return to normal. If the messaging, however, is we're going to very slowly open things up, be ready to self-isolate again, be ready to shelter in place again, then I think that people will hesitate before booking anything. I have a conference that for an organization I happen to be president of right now that's still on for October. It's in the States. I am nearing 100% certainty that I'm not going to be able to go. If I can go, I would definitely want to. And if the information that's available at the time says it's safe, I would probably use that as a reason to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm definitely on the boat of if the government or officials say it's safe, I'm going to travel as soon as I get the opportunity. I think then there's people like my wife, frankly, who are like, well, why don't we wait a little bit? Who knows if this will come back or what have you? So it's interesting to see the degrees. And I guess that really boils down to whether you're a traveler yourself or not, and risk taking level the risk that you're willing to take and so forth. I don't want to hijack and make this conversation all about COVID, even though there's some really fascinating things happening. I do want to dig into one more aspect of consumer behavior that's going to change. You know, for example, and I'll just use, again, a personal example. Wife and I used to go to the grocery store nearest our house. We're lucky we have a couple of options here. Now we are almost exclusively online shopping for our groceries. Do you see Canadians changing those kind of behaviors? Do you think after this is over, Canadians will still elect for the convenience to buy stuff off Amazon, buy stuff online versus going to stores, going to malls? Or do you see those retail stores being able to recover?
There's a lot to unpack in your question. I'll start with the behavioral side and then we'll worry about whether or not the stores will be able to reopen, because I think there's more going on there. Online shopping by this point in time is fairly ubiquitous. Everyone is pretty much used to it. Most people have done it. Most people have not done it for things like groceries. I think what you'll find is people who were open to the idea beforehand, people who said, you know what, I'd like to try that, or I don't enjoy going to the grocery store, I should give it a shot. I think they will be willing to continue, as long as it's not too expensive, as long as the convenience level is still there. For people like me, I enjoy going to the grocery store. I think about food a lot. I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a foodie, but I definitely focus on food as an important part of my life. I will not stop going to the grocery. I actually have still been going to the grocery once a week and taking all the precautions, because I have no willingness to buy my groceries online. If I had to, I would, obviously, but I don't have to, so I'm not going to. I think you're going to see a lot of difference between the different types of people. The other element you asked about is the retail stores recovering. I think that has much more to do with whether or not they can remain viable during this shutdown, as to whether or not they're going to reopen, than if there's a demand for their services when it's done. I think those that survive it, those that can continue paying their rent, those that can continue, can hold on to their employees, or at least get their employees to wait until this is over, I think it's possible they may have an advantage if there's a shakeout and a lot of retailers go under, because they'll be left and there'll be enough customers that want to get out of the house and want to go to the stores. But like anything else, they still have to make sure they're offering products that have value to consumers at fair prices, and make sure their consumers are aware and interested in what they're doing.
Awesome. Yeah. Fast forward to us being back at the malls are open. Stores are open. Restaurants are open. Canadians are back out spending.
Maybe so like 2023 or so?
2023, yeah. Maybe we can imagine for a moment a world that where COVID-19 didn't happen. Unfortunately, debts per consumer in Canada have been growing steadily. Consumer debt, credit card debt, line of credit, and so forth has been growing steadily. Do you think Canadians have a debt problem? And if so, I mean, sorry, that's a bad question. They do have a debt. Most of them do have a debt problem. But why do you think it is that Canadians have such a debt problem?
I think there's a number of factors. This isn't really my area of expertise in terms of debt, so I probably know less about this than you do in terms of why Canadians have debt. From a consumer standpoint, debt is easy. Debt is easy to incur. We see what we want. We see other people have what we want, and we think, why can't I have that too? We look at our neighbor, and we see our neighbor drives a nicer car than we do, or keeps seemingly is doing home renovations, and we think, well, I live in the same neighborhood. I know what sort of job they have and can probably estimate their salary. I should be able to afford that too. There's the whole sense of, I'm not a grown-up until I own a house, for example. People underestimate the cost of things, not just the sticker price, but what something will end up costing all told. And so because we've got these two factors, one is we have this great desire to keep up with our neighbors or our friends or our peers, and we see all this stuff that we could be buying, and at the same time, it's pretty easy to buy it, we get this effect where people take on debt. They see it as manageable. They spend money that they haven't earned yet. All of these things are shown in spending literature and spending academic literature that, for example, people are much more willing to spend on a credit card than they are willing to spend if they have cash, because we can see the cash deplete, whereas we don't necessarily see the debt accumulate.
Visa doesn't mind.
No.
Very good. I wanted to go back. I know your area of expertise. I did look you up, by the way, was on pricing and pricing perception. One of the articles that you wrote, I found particularly interesting, mainly because both actually Tyler and I live near the Up Express. I do remember when it first came out thinking to myself, I don't know where they think they're going to get $27.50 for a one-way ride. It seems like you shared that sentiment, and we can use that as an anchor for the conversation, but how does price or dropping the price from $27.50, how does an organization who needs to find that balance between how much Canadians are willing to pay and what I need to make a profit, how does an organization go about kind of reaching that balance?
Sure. We can use the Up Express if you like. So that's a business case I wrote to use in the classroom with my students. So I don't want to give away too much in case that some of them listen to this. I don't want them to know what the answer is. But to answer your question of how a company determines what a person would be willing to pay for a price, for a product rather. You know, how much is someone willing to pay? How much value do they hold for this product? First of all, keep in mind, most companies, most of the time, do not set their prices based on how much they think someone is willing to pay. Most companies, most of the time, set their prices based on what it costs them to deliver that service or to acquire that product. So if you go to a hardware store and you buy a hammer, no one in an office sat down and said, really, let me figure out how much a customer would value this hammer. More likely, almost certainly, they said, it cost us $2 to acquire this hammer from our distributor, so we want to make 100% markup on this product, so we're going to sell this hammer for $4. So that's the first part. For those companies that do look at how much this is worth, there's a process called value to consumer analysis, VTC, value to consumer. And what you do to conduct a value to consumer analysis is, first, you take your product and you look at, well, what is the closest comparable product in the eyes of the consumer? So if we look at the Up Express, what would a person do to get to the airport from downtown Toronto if they didn't use the Up Express? What are some ways you guys can think of?
TTC to Kipling, and then there's the airport bus.
Sure,
there's that. An Uber.
So we can pay $3.25 and take the TTC the whole way. That's going to take me about an hour and 20 minutes. I have to change lines. I have to change from a subway to a bus. There's a lot of hassle. Is there an easier way I can do this?
Taxi.
I can take a taxi. How much is a taxi to the airport? It's $55 from at the time anyway. It was $55. So I can pay $55 to take a taxi, or I can take the Up Express. So the first step is finding that comparable price point. The next step is identifying all the ways that taking a taxi is different from taking the Up Express, both ways that the Up Express is better and ways that the Up Express is worse. So you know, because I'm a prof and this is the way I communicate with my students, tell me, what are some ways that the Up Express is different from taking a taxi?
I'll give you, and again, this is just because of where Tyler and I are located, but I literally walk 3 minutes to the Dundas West stop on the Up Express. So I used to live in the Annex, though, and I used to have this discussion with my wife. As I mentioned, we're travelers. I used to always be like willing to pay that $55 to get home soon versus Up Express, transfer to the TTC. Now it's just no debate. The value for me, because we live right next to the station, is I'm door to door within about 35 minutes.
Yep. So the time, definitely. And it's not just the time, it's the reliability of the time. If I get in a taxi, I'm subject to traffic. I can't be certain of when I'm going to get to the airport. If I get in the Up Express, then I know I'm getting there from Union. I'm getting there in 22, 25 minutes, and I can rely on that. Great. But what are some ways a taxi is better?
It's like a private ride, a private driver.
Yep.
You're in your own space. It's got trunk.
Yep.
The taxi is probably going to help you unload. You get off right at the terminal door.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So what we want to do, and we would obviously, if we were doing this as the Up Express, we would make a much more exhaustive list, but we want to find these differences. That's the second step. The third step is then to value these differences. How much more is it worth to have a private ride versus a train ride? How much more is it worth to know you're going to get there at a certain time than be subject to when there is traffic in Toronto? And so we have to value these. Now, sometimes what we value can be valued objectively. We can look at something like, if I take a taxi, I just get in, I call it, and I just get in out right outside my door. If I'm going to the Up Express and I don't happen to live right near Union or Dundas West, I have to take the TTC. So that's a $3.25 charge that I know I have to pay. And when I say we have to value these differences, we're valuing these differences in terms of money. So if it's an objective difference like that, we just say, okay, I'm someone who lives at near Davisville. I have to take the subway down to at least Bloor, possibly down to Union. That's going to cost me $3. So it's $3 more expensive for me to take the Up Express, which means the Up Express is worth $3 less. For something subjective, like what is it worth to have your own private taxi ride, that's more difficult to determine. And you need to do a lot of marketing research. You need to do a lot of consumer research to get into that. You need to do different types of analyses like conjoint analysis. If you just ask customers, hey, how much more are you willing to pay for a taxi ride versus the Up Express? That's a really difficult question for most people to answer because they've never thought of it in those terms. But if you say you could take a taxi ride for $20 more or the Up Express for this price, people can answer that more easily. So there's ways of doing this research, ways of doing these analyses to tease out those differences. If your job was setting the price for the Up Express, you should be doing this market research. If you are a student in my pricing class, then I don't expect that necessarily, but I do expect, you know, you think about it and you think, okay, what might it be worth? So the third step is placing a value on all of these. If we're the Up Express, then every way the Up Express is better, you're putting a positive value. Every way the Up Express is worse, you're putting in negative value. And so then what you do is, for the fourth step, you add all of these up. So we started with a $55 cab ride. We have some ways that the Up Express is better, so we added to that $55. We have some ways that the Up Express is worse, so we subtracted from that $55. And we end up with a number. And that number, if we've done everything appropriately, represents the value that the Up Express has for the consumer.
So did the Up Express do this?
Not at all.
Right? Yeah, okay.
As I said, I don't want to give away too much, but okay, essentially, yeah, okay. If you do the math, they have a $70 million annual operating cost for the Up Express. And they had a whole bunch of, if you looked at the case I wrote, you see they have a whole bunch of reports from consultants that try out different prices. What they were trying to do is say, you know, as the price increases, we expect fewer riders. We expect there to be some price elasticity of demand. We expect that as prices go up, demand goes down. So what we want to find is the sweet spot where the price times the number of people who would go at that price covers our costs. Go ahead.
Sorry, this sort of infuriates me a little bit because was it not publicly funded too, the Up Express?
It's a Metrolinx project,
right?
But it had, you know, the it cost the province 450 odd million dollars to build, but there's a $70 million annual operating cost. So what they were trying to do was cover that cost with the fares. And what they did was they found consultants, and I'm not saying anyone did anything right or wrong, but they found a group of consultants who told them, if you charge around $30, you'll get this many riders, and that will cover the $70 million. The flaw in that thinking is they don't know for certain, essentially, that it's true. They know that more people will ride it at a lower price and fewer people will ride it at a higher price. But those numbers don't necessarily match the reality of what was going to happen. And some of the reasons for that are obvious, right? At a really high price, essentially they set it at half the price of a cab ride. If I'm two people going on vacation, if I'm not a lone business person, now it's the same price for me to take a cab as it is for me to take the Up Express. So why on earth would I? The other thing that then happened is they looked at it and say, well, that sweet spot that I mentioned earlier is a fairly high price. So we better get a target market that wants to pay a high price or is willing to pay a high price. They looked at it and they said, well, executives and business people traveling from downtown Toronto, they'll pay a high price because either they make a lot of money or their company is paying their expenses or what else. And so they ended up with this situation where not only did they then charge a high price, they tried to position the train as a luxury product.
Yeah.
If I'm a high-powered business person and I need to get to the airport, I'll take a limo.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Especially if my company is paying for it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So there was a disconnect between the sort of internal analysis around what we should charge and the reality of the market is what I found.
The most infuriating thing for me is like it's the Dundas West Station is across the street from the TTC. And then it's also the GO train runs through there. It's the Kitchener line of the GO train. And each of these are public commuter trains now at charging different rates and different fares between the same locations.
Yes.
And it used to be that the Up was fancy and like, oh yeah, you can get free Wi-Fi and everything's great. The Wi-Fi doesn't even work anymore because there's so many people riding on it and it's jam packed.
Yeah. They at the time, based on the news articles at the time, the making it a commuter train was the last thing they wanted to do. This was supposed to be a high profile project and they didn't want it to become yet another commuter train, especially one that mostly, as you mentioned, shared a line with the TTC and the Kitchener GO line. But if you look at value between the Up Express and the Kitchener GO line doesn't quite get you to the airport. It gets you close. Yeah. You know, Malton Station is close, but that little extra bit you would have to go in a cab or on a bus is all the difference.
And so should people apply this to like when they're buying clothes or when they're spending at restaurants, should they apply this same sort of pricing behavior to determine value then?
Well, the determining of value I'm talking about is on the side of the business.
Yeah.
Any consumer by default, when they buy something, is doing this. They're looking at, I have to hand over this much money and I get this in return. So you are making a value judgment. That value might go far beyond the product itself. So as an example, back when we used to go to the movie theater, you could go and you could you get your popcorn and your drink. And you'd look at it and you'd say, that's fairly expensive for popcorn and drink, but I'm used to it. We have norms that at the movie theater, it's more expensive, et cetera, et cetera. So you go up and you say, I want a regular popcorn. I want a regular drink. And the person behind the counter, they'll say, well, do you want upsize to a large? Rationally, if you had wanted a large all along, you would have asked for a large. But there may be factors that would cause you to say yes, though, even though that isn't what you initially wanted. Factors like you could be with friends or with a significant other, and you're thinking, I don't want to look cheap, or I want to be able to share. Factors like, you know what, it's only 50 cents to upsize. Now I'm a smart shopper. I'm getting value from the fact that I'm getting a deal. Even though now I'm spending more to get something I didn't necessarily want at the beginning. Maybe the popcorn comes in a fancy tub and you think, oh, I want that kicking around my apartment for a few months before I decide it's stupid and throw it away. That can have something to do with it. The mistake that we make as consumers is when we plan for our purchases and we will look back on our purchases, oftentimes we like to think of ourselves as rational actors, as I am making a rational, sensible decision exchanging this much money for this specific benefit. I am buying this sweater because it keeps me warm. There's nothing wrong with saying, I'm buying this sweater because I happen to like the color, or I something about the design or the logo on it or whatever else. But we try and justify our purchases and saying this is a sensible purchase most of the time.
Okay, we are going to jump into rapid fire questions, if that's all right with
that's
you.
That's great.
Our first question, what is in your wallet?
My wallet, credit cards, driver's license, Costco card, and a few points cards.
What book do you think everyone should read?
Everyone should read. That's a big question. It'd be easier if you just ask what book I'm reading now. What book everyone should read? I'm going to say... You know, I'm going to go with my initial thought. A book called Fooled by Randomness by Nicholas Nassim Taleb. I don't agree necessarily with his current politics and everything he's saying, but that book definitely gives you a very interesting insight into how the world works.
Great. And just to follow up, what are you reading right now?
Right now, I'm reading a book called Nixonland. It's about the 1960s in the U.S. and the beginnings of this sort of very divisive, very partisan political landscape you're seeing there now.
What's your favorite movie and why?
I hate picking favorites. My favorite movie and why, it's going to sound cliched, my favorite movie is The Godfather. And why it has changed over the years. Right now, it's because it does change over the years. I first saw The Godfather when I was a teenager. I've watched it periodically through my life since then. And every time I see it, I get something different out of it because I've changed and I'm in a different place in my life than I was.
Absolutely. I've read the book, and I've seen probably all three movies a number of times in my life for sure. Mm-hmm. Where do you spend most of your money every week?
The biggest chunk, I would guess, goes to groceries. To be honest, my wife handles all of our bills and expenses, so she would have a much better sense of where all our money goes. But yeah, I would say it's probably the grocery store gets the biggest chunk of our money.
If you had one tweet, 280 characters that everyone in the world was going to read, what would it say?
I don't even need 280 characters. This too shall pass.
Yeah.
Very good one. Very good one.
It's relevant.
Yeah, definitely relevant. So what's your number? What do you need to live comfortably and be independently wealthy in your terms?
I'd say probably $15-20 million before I would say I'm giving up everything. I'm just going to live off that.
That was a lot easier than I was expecting it to be. Okay, we'll see if you can pick this one up. But what would you do if you won $48,402?
I would question why it was that exact money, amount of money. 48.
Well, on our.
I think $46,402 plus a $2,000 bonus.
$46,402 plus a $200 bonus.
$2,000 bonus. We basically.
Oh, yes. I know. Okay. Got it. Yeah. I would use it to prepare for the arrival of my son, who was born around that time.
Okay. Oh,
and Tyler or Eric, one of you have the listeners are going to be dying to know what we were talking there. Eric, do you want to share with our listeners some of the research that Tyler and I were found on you? Is not just your excerpt on the UP Express pricing comparison debacle.
Sure. Yes, I am a former Jeopardy champion. Back in 2006, I was on three episodes of Jeopardy. I won two of them, and then the third one, unfortunately, I lost, so I had to leave. It was a great experience. I won $48,402 over the 3 days. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
That is so cool. That is so
very cool. I'm definitely telling my wife when this is over. I spoke to a Jeopardy champ today.
yeah.
Last question. What is the most expensive thing you ever bought, not including your house and your car?
My MBA.
Yeah. Great, great answer.
The PhD was cheaper?
The PhD was cheaper. Actually, PhD students get subsidized for a big part of the tuition.
Okay.
Speaking of the PhD, too, I think you're the first podcast guest who turned it around on the host and started firing questions at them. We would expect nothing less from the professor, though. So appreciate the time, Eric, and appreciate that you did that as well.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
If you wanted anybody to be able to reach out to you, or where can people reach out to you if they have more questions?
Sure.
Or where should they find you?
Yeah. So my email's on the web on Brock's website. It's edolansky, E-D-O-L-A-N-S-K-Y at brocku.ca. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is at uncertainprof.
And then, of course, they can sign up for one of your classes, too.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not teaching again till the fall, but all signs are indicating that I'm going to be teaching online. So that might open it up to a lot more people taking my class.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be relevant to many. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very
much. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. And just...
Now, it's time to take a withdrawal from the knowledge bank.
How to get cheap car insurance. Not all car insurance is created equal. Premiums can vary by company, by car, by location, and by drivers. It's best to shop around to find your best rate. Here's a bunch of ideas on how you can save on car insurance. Number 1. Choose the right car. Some cars are cheaper to insure than others. If a car is in fewer accidents, offers more safety features, is stolen less, it'll be cheaper to insure. Here's a weird fact. Minivans are generally cheaper to insure than most four-door sedans because of who drives them. Minivan drivers are usually parents with kids who are more cautious drivers than, say, young drivers who bought a compact sedan because it was cheap. Statistically, young drivers get in more accidents, which is why a cheap compact could be more to insure than a minivan. Number 2. Know what coverage you need. There are mandated minimums to any policy, but you can still customize the policy to your needs. If you're driving an older car, you might consider dropping collision and comprehensive coverage from your policy and put that money to buying a new car. You might also consider increasing your deductible, the portion of a claim you pay before your insurer pays the rest. Increasing your deductible signals to your provider that you won't be making small claims and they'll reward you for it. Number 3. Consider usage-based insurance. Car insurance rates are based on stereotypes and statistics. If you feel you're a better driver than your demographic, many insurers now have apps that track your driving. How far you drive, how hard you brake, how fast you accelerate, and how you handle turns can all be sent to your insurer to get a more personalized rate for you. Number 4. Bundle. Got home or tenants insurance? Drive more than one car? If you have multiple policies with one insurer, they'll often give you a discount. Number 5. Ask for discounts. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. Many insurers offer discounts to university alumni or for union members. Ask and see if you qualify. Number 6. Drive safe, stay loyal. A long history of accident-free driving will yield cheaper insurance rates. Number 7. Get the right gear. Winter tires and immobilizers means fewer accidents and thefts. Insurance companies like that. Number 8. Take a course. An educated driver is a safer driver, and you'll be rewarded for it. Number 9. Shop around. Don't let your policy auto-renew. Shop around to make sure you're paying the best price. You can compare car insurance quotes on ratehub.ca in about 5 minutes for free. Auto insurance providers use different calculations to deliver rates. No one insurer will charge you the same price. Follow those tips to get cheaper car insurance. Happy shopping! Thank you for listening. Thank you to Beat Chemist for providing us with our music. Find him on SoundCloud. I want to sincerely thank you for taking the time out of your own day and investing it in yourself to get smarter about money. Head over to ratehub.ca to learn more about making smarter financial decisions. If you want to thank us, please leave a review on Apple Podcast and follow us on Spotify. Thank you for listening. Let's help Canadians choose better with their finances.
The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. The views and opinions expressed by RateHub employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the views of RateHub Inc. or any of its sponsors or officials. This is for general use. We're not certified or licensed advisors.
Yeah, we just don't want to get sued.